Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Well, precious Blood River Radio brothers and sisters that listen to us, thank you so much for hanging on. This is going to be a very interesting hour. Our Blood River Radio sisters dropped off. Sister Nancy said she wanted to end on a funny note. Sister Monica's gone. She's doing stuff. She's taken over a lot of the administrative chores. For instance, she helps a lot with the show notes now. And that we send off to the webmaster. But anyway, I love her for doing that. Lord knows I hate those administrative skills. I'm not good at any of them, any of those things. But anyway, we have the bitter ender here, and Gene, and I guarantee you he is like Dr. Hill, some ways better in Philly. He can fill the hour from wall to wall, from the ceiling to the floor, and it's all with just this. If you were to put. It's like putting this high-powered soap in water. One drop, well, you could wash the whole sink of dishes. A minute of Gene is like an hour in a regular history course. So we'll go ahead, Bitter Ender. Let us know what we're going to be doing tonight.
Well, thank you, Commander. Thank you for the compliments. I'll send you that $20 I owe you then. So we'll get that taken
yes,
care
sir.
Of. No, we're going to have our Confederate History Hour here, and I'm sorry Nancy couldn't be with us. She's such a great researcher. That young lady can find any fact you have. She can find it anywhere in the world, and she is just one of the best researchers I've ever talked to. She does a great job. But we're going to cover some Confederate history events that took place during the month of March and cover several years, of course, from 1861 up through toward the end of the war. And first, though, we had talked earlier in the week about maybe starting with just a little bit of humor. We had a letter published to the editor in the Barnes Review, and I want to give a plug to the Barnes Review. It is a super great magazine for our history people and our conservatives. The heading across the front of it goes, "The Barnes Review, a journal of politically incorrect history." And they give you all the facts on historical events that actually happened from, oh, good night, way back in almost prehistoric days up through the modern times. They're very conservative, as I said. They're very pro-Southern. Paul Angel is the editor of that, and also he's the editor of the American Free Press, which is another conservative publication. And James Edwards has articles in there in the American Free Press quite a few times. So both very good publications if you want to get what's really going on and not have to wade through all the garbage on CNN and ABC and NBC and all of that. So they have a section, Letters to the Editor, and this is a reference back to an article they had in their January-February publication. Comes out six times a year. And so it starts off with, "Having read the giddy news stories from the prostitutes in the lamestream media, and the accurate follow-up, though, in History You May Have Missed," which is a column they always have in every issue, "the History You May Have Missed item in the January-February 2023 issue of the Barnes Review, may I humbly offer a simple suggestion to the low IQ retarded primates destroying the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, a Virginian in Charlottesville, Virginia. Rather having to cut up and melt down the entire statue to make medallions for some black criminal or neo-Bolshevik organization, let me offer a practical suggestion to save time. The Lee statue is an equestrian statue. General Lee is mounted on his beloved war horse, Traveler. Simply move to the rear of the horse, lift Traveler's tail, cut the rear end out of poor old Traveler, and one would already have a perfect medallion representing an uncanny likeness to George Floyd, St. George Floyd, or Al Sharpton, Maxine Waters, or, well, you get the idea. And one could use white spray paint, and shazam, you would have a perfect replica of Nancy Pelosi, or Elizabeth Warren, or Liz Cheney, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or, well, the possibilities are endless. just trying to be helpful and offer an artsy suggestion to enhance our wonderful, diverse culture. And that's signed by Gene Andrews from Occupied Tennessee, CSA. So, just trying to help out there, Eddie, and improve our relationship and with all the disgruntled folks out there.
Well, I tell you what, we always pride ourselves as being a community, giving a great community service and education. And
well, that's what I'm trying to do.
Yes. And so that's exactly what you're trying to do. So I think that epitomizes what we're trying to do here at Blood River Radio. We're at their service. Yes, sir. I will go
just
along with that.
I'll tell you what, that's all.
Blood River Radio, we'll even take out of the Blood River Radio bank account to donate the first can of white paint.
All right. You're all heart, Edward. All heart.
Yes.
All heart.
Yes. Yes, sir. Amen to that.
Let's move on from that and try to upgrade the program a little bit. Going on to our Confederate history for March. And what we'd like to start off with is Confederate Flag Day. And we usually celebrate that in the SCV as the first Saturday in March. And actually, it was on March the 4th, 1861, that the first official flag of the newly formed Confederate States of America was presented. And as any new country, it went through many flags for practical reasons. And people always say, well, they couldn't get the flag right. No wonder they couldn't win the war. Well, the United States changed that flag for over 20 years, off and on. It started out originally with adding a star and a stripe for each new state that came in. And then after a while, they got too many stripes, so they decided to cut it back to the 7 red, 6 white stripes and just add a star for each new state that came in. So the first actual flag, and for our listening audience, we were going to have this broadcast to you in living color, but Eddie was too cheap to buy a TV set for everybody that tunes in and listens. So
yes,
we'll just give you a little on-air description of these flags. I think most of you have already seen them anyway. The first Confederate flag was the South Carolina secession flag. And it was a red flag with a swallowtail. The end opposite from the flagpole had a V cut out of the flag. I think you've all seen that, like a guidon flag in the military. So it was red, and it had a crescent and a star. And that was a symbol of secession. And a lot of the Confederate soldiers wore a metal crescent and a star on their hat or on their lapel on the coat. And a lot of the men wore that when the state was voting on whether they were going to secede or not. It's kind of like wearing a political ribbon or a button today, you know, I like Ike or something like that. But the crescent and star meant you were pro-secession, and the ladies would wear a red, white, and red ribbon, not red, white, and blue. And if you got caught wearing that in Maryland, Lincoln would have you thrown in jail. And they used Fort McHenry as a political prison in Baltimore Harbor. And the irony was that one of the prisoners they had there wrote a letter, and the last time I was in Baltimore, they actually had this in the museum there, wrote a letter saying, how ironic that I'm being held here as a prisoner for my Southern beliefs, and my grandfather wrote their Star Spangled Banner on a British warship just right down the harbor. So it was Francis Scott Key's grandson. They got thrown in jail in Fort McHenry, where the Star Spangled Banner was written, well, not there, but right down the harbor on a British warship, where his grandfather wrote the Star Spangled Banner. So that was the South Carolina secession flag. It flew from the Customs House in Charleston the day after South Carolina voted to secede on December 20th, 1860. And the reason they chose the Customs House, because that was what the war was really about. The Lincoln administration wanting to collect taxes from the seceded states. And they said, I don't think we're going to pay taxes to a foreign country. That's not going to happen. So with Lincoln's election, he began his tax war, and they put that flag over the Customs House after South Carolina seceded. The next flag that was used was a flag called the Bonnie Blue Flag. It was a blue flag with a single white star in the middle of it. And a lot of the states back then didn't have state flags like we do today. So several of the states, when they seceded, they were not in the United States. And most of these states pulled out in January of 61. They were not in the United States, but the Confederate states hadn't been formed yet. So they would have to have some kind of other flag to represent their state. And several of the new seceded states, like I said, it wasn't the Confederate States of America just yet, used this blue flag with the white star, which had a long history in the South. It flew over the West Florida Republic in 1810. It was the star, star flag that they used for the Republic of Texas, 1836. And it was flown over the Capitol building in Jackson, Mississippi, when Mississippi voted to secede and leave the Union. And in the crowd that day was an Irishman by the name of Harry McCarthy. And he was so impressed by what he saw there that he went back to his hotel room that night and wrote several of the verses of the song, The Mighty Blue Flag.
Oh.
And that was one of the most popular songs in the South at that time, even more so than Dixie.
Well, Bitterender, we have to go to our first break, brother. We'll be right back then as soon as we get through this break. Hang on, folks.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at CSPOA.org. That's CSPOA.org.
A Bienus is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Dear Blood River Radio family, I tell you what, I hope you're profiting. Not only is it enjoyable, but this history you're getting, especially for our young people, you really need it. It's really vital. Man doesn't live by bread alone. That's true. But I mean, without knowledge, without knowing where you came from, where your roots lie, you're so you being people that have to, especially the young. I'll just paraphrase Karl Marx. Karl Marx said that if we can get our young people, if we can get them separated from their roots, for they don't know where they came from. We can easily mold them to take them where we want them to go. And you know where the hardcore Bolshevik communism would take you. It's leading to death. So that's why these history lessons are so vital. It's not just entertainment. As entertaining as it is, especially our young people, need to hear this. Anyway, without further ado, go ahead, Bitterender, continue on, brother.
Well, you're exactly right. The communists called it the Long March Through the Institutions. And the first thing they were going to do was take over the colleges and universities and have their stooges appointed as department chairmen, and get rid of any conservative that was teaching political science, history, sociology, whatever, get them out of there and put the communist propaganda in place. And then take over the news media, take over the all the entertainment industry. And they've been very successful. They've done it.
Yes,
so anyway, we were talking. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eddie.
Oh no, I was just gonna say yes, they have. But you know what? We're doing what we can to counter that.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we are. And I take pride in having people like Gene on here. And Gene and I just consider it a blessing not to me, not just to me, but to our people out there, to have people like Gene and Nancy on. Well, all of our people, all of our staff, but Gene is, if you know, he's like, he's a professor, so is Nancy. And that's why I feel blessed, along with our people, especially the young people, to be, if you can take some pride in who you are, you won't be beat down by these people telling you that you were born, if you're white, you were born racist, your Confederate ancestors were scum, your Waffen SS soldiers, relatives were scum. Now, that's a bunch of crap. If you hang on to Blood River, if you listen to us here, people like Gene, I hope it'll give you not just a great education, but great hope. But I hope it didn't go too long there, Gene. Go ahead, brother.
No, sir. No, sir. We, right before the break, we were talking about some of the variations of Confederate flags that were used before the official flag was adopted. We were talking about the Bonnie Blue flag. There were several others. But then the Confederate Congress appointed a flag committee to come up with a flag for the new country. And they wanted to try to get it in place before Lincoln was inaugurated, because back then the presidents were inaugurated in middle of March instead of January like we have today. So they appointed this flag committee, and they opened it up to people from all over the South to send in their suggestions, and some of them were pretty good. And there were one or two, I saw one in particular that had fish jumping out of the water, had a palm tree, and had a sunset in the background. Nice advertisement for Florida, but I think they told them, don't call us, we'll call you on that one, okay? And one of the designs, though, that was turned in was by a gentleman by the name of William Porcher Miles of South Carolina. And it was a red flag with a blue diagonal cross on it, like we all assume the Confederate flag is today. And the only problem was it only had seven states at the time. And it was kind of hard to balance seven stars on four arms of the flag. And the other thing that really killed it, they cut it down to about the final four or the Sweet 16 or however many they had. They were hanging up in the Senate chamber in the Capitol building at Montgomery. So they were hanging vertically. And one of the senators said, well, I ain't voting for a flag. It looks like a pair of suspenders hanging up there. So it got the axe. The flag they did come up with was the first national flag of the Confederacy. And this was the government flag. It had a blue canton in the upper left-hand corner, or blue square, and then a red, white, red stripe, and a circle of seven stars. So in the blue canton. So it was referred to as the Stars and Bars. And now the news nerds will call the battle flag that we're all familiar with, oh, controversy over the Stars and Bars, details at 6. Well, that lets you know right there they don't know what they're talking about. So it was designed, though, to look similar to the Revolutionary War flag, because a lot of the people on that flag committee had fathers or grandfathers that fought in our first war for independence. And they said, if the U.S. won't leave us in peace, this time we're going to have to fight the second war for independence, not against King George III of England, but against King Abraham I of the United States. Now, the first national flag was fine when it was flying over the Capitol building or the post office, or they were waving it at the train depot when the boys were leaving. But the problem they ran into was the first big battle of the war at Manassas, because when this flag was hanging limp on the flagpole or obscured with smoke and dust, it looked too much like the U.S. flag. So they decided, okay, we'll keep this for the government flag, but we'll go back to that design that Mr. Miles came up with, and we'll use that flag for our military flag, the battle flag. Now, after Lincoln called for troops to invade the South, we had 6 more states that bailed out on dishonest Abe. So now you had 13 states, 13 stars, and they could be balanced on 4 arms of the flag and 1 in the middle. So the battle flag, as we said, was the red flag with the diagonal cross. And it was referred to as the Southern Cross, it was referred to as the Celtic Cross, and it was also referred to as the Cross of St. Andrew. And the diagonal cross that's white on a blue background is the flag of Scotland. And, of course, Andrew was the patron saint of Scotland, and he was crucified on a diagonal cross. He said he wasn't worthy of being crucified on a cross like Jesus was crucified on. So that was the Scottish flag, Cross of St. Andrew, the Celtic Cross, since the Scots were Celtic people, or the Southern Cross. And there were variations of that. The Army of Northern Virginia carried a square battle flag. The Army of Tennessee, we always have to be different from our Virginia cousins, had a diagonal flag. And the Trans-Mississippi out there across the big river, Richard Taylor's units out there had a reverse color field. It had a red diagonal cross on it and a blue background. And the story goes that they gave a picture to some ladies that were going to sew the flags, but they didn't have color photography back then. And the picture was from a newspaper, and the ladies assumed that the flag was blue and had a red diagonal cross on it. And, of course, they'd never been to Virginia to see the flags up there. So that's what they sewed up for them. And they gave them the flags, and they looked at it and go, whoa, wait a minute. But they were going into battle. So it was too late to go back and say, okay, ladies, please start all over again, and then we need the red flag with the blue diagonal cross. So they carried it anyway, and they won a huge upset victory over a much larger Yankee army. And they came back and said, there's no way we're going to change this flag. It's good luck. So they kept it. And then you had all sorts of flags for different Army Corps, a Hardy Corps flag, which was a blue flag. What's out here in Tennessee or the Western Theater, it was a blue flag with either a white circle or oval, and a Polk flag that was designed by General Leonidas Polk. It was a blue flag with a red cross of St. George, a vertical stripe and then a horizontal stripe. And we had the Cherokee Rifles, which is a variation of the First National flag, the Choctaw Braves. The Indian nation sided with the Confederacy, and they fought battles under the Confederate flags, different ones, in Missouri and Arkansas and even out in the Indian nations, which is today Oklahoma. And we had a Confederate Marine Corps flag, which was the first national flag with the circle of stars, and it had an MC inside that circle of stars on a First National flag. And then there were several flags in Kentucky that Nancy could tell you about for the Orphans Brigade that had the Christian cross on the flag, either in stars, made into the cross was made out of stars, or it was on there. And the Cockrell's Missouri Brigade out of Missouri was a blue flag with a white Christian cross on it. Then in May of 1863, the battle flag became so popular that they decided to incorporate that into the second national flag. So they put a small version of the battle flag up in the canton or the corner of the first national flag, dropped out that blue canton and put the battle flag in there. And they thought, well, that's too much red, so they dropped off the two red stripes. So now in the upper left corner of the flag, you had a square battle flag, an all-white field. It's sometimes referred to as a stainless banner. And and the first time that it was officially used by the government, unfortunately, this flag was used to cover the casket of Stonewall Jackson when he died from his wounds at Chancellorsville and was brought back to Lexington to be buried there. So that was the first time that that flag was officially used. Now, once again, they ran into another problem. There was too much white on the flag. So if that flag were hanging limp, it looked too much like a flag of surrender or truce. So the third national flag was designed and passed by the Confederate Congress in March of 1865. Very few of those were made or issued because, for all intents and purposes, the war ended pretty much in April of 65. So it really wasn't used that much in the field and very seldom by the government. And the funny story on that is I had a good friend in Georgia, Hank Gusner, and I made a reference to the third national flag of the Confederacy, and he jumped all over me and said, Andrews, you're such a pathetic little girl high school cheerleader. It's not the third national flag. It's the current national flag. So, Hank, I stand corrected on that. So you got to watch out for your friends jumping on you and giving you a hard time.
Amen to that, so, brother.
Yeah. If it weren't for my friends, we wouldn't have any enemies out there at all. Another item we'd like to cover for March is today, the 16th of March. That is the birthday of the Confederate Major General Patrick Ronayne Cleburne, who was born in County Cork, Ireland on March 16th, 1828, and a most interesting individual. And he was a brilliant, brilliant division commander, probably should have been commander of the entire Army of Tennessee if certain things hadn't happened. He was that good. So we'll go back to General Cleburne right after the break.
He's one of my favorites. Be right back, folks.
Listening to Liberty News Radio. USA News, I'm Dave Collins. Nathan Wade will not be part of the prosecution in the Donald Trump election interference case in Georgia. He submitted his resignation following the judge's ruling Friday that Fulton County DA Fawny Willis could remain on the case if Special Prosecutor Wade was removed. Wade, who is in a romantic relationship with Willis, said in a statement he's stepping down in the interest of democracy and to move the case forward as quickly as possible. President Biden visited Capitol Hill Friday, where he greeted the Irish Prime Minister at the White House and addressed the Friends of Ireland luncheon hosted by Speaker Mike Johnson.
And, the friendship goes back centuries, but today is an important period, an important milestone. Nearly 100 years of diplomatic relations, Taoiseach, and every 100 years of Ireland and the United States.
During his remarks, Biden condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine and urged the House pass a comprehensive national security package already approved by the Senate. However, Johnson has been hesitant to advance the legislation, citing concerns over border provisions. Mike Pence is not endorsing former President Trump. The former VP said Trump does not promote the same conservative values they pushed during their 4 years together. While he would not say who he's voting for, he said he absolutely will not vote for President Biden. Officials say a tornado in Ohio killed at least three people. Multiple injuries were caused by a tornado in Indiana. A total of five tornadoes were confirmed in Ohio. A tornado also damaged at least 50 structures in a small northern Kentucky town near the Indiana border. Consumers are expected to spend over $22 billion this Easter. That's according to the National Retail Federation. 81% of Americans plan to celebrate Easter this year. This is USA News.
Greece is cheap.
But the airfare costs a fortune.
Paris?
Not much closer. And again, airfare.
What about Puerto Vallarta?
Let's face it, flying anywhere is just too expensive.
Wait, what's this? Low-cost airlines.
With one call to low-cost airlines, you'll drastically slash your travel costs. We're talking insanely low airline prices to any of your favorite destinations. Where would you like to go? London, Rome, Costa Rica, Australia?
Wow, that's cheap.
So why wait? Call now to learn how crazy cheap it is to fly anywhere in the U.S. or international. Our prices are so low, we can't publish them. The only way to get them is to call to instantly hear the most amazing best deals on airlines. Travel. It's that easy. So call now and start packing.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
This is Attorney Jason Robb, General Counsel of the Knights Party based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent, and if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more while listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Oh,
Well, dear Blood River Radio family, without further taking up any more time, me flapping my jaws, we're going to go right back to the historian, the one and only Bitter Ender. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, before our break, Eddie, we were talking about a birthday on this date, March the 16th, back in 1828, of Patrick Ronayne Claiborne. As a major general in the Confederate Army, and served with distinction. In fact, he was so good that they nicknamed him the Stonewall of the West. And he fought on most of the major battles of the Confederate Army of Tennessee, all the way from Shiloh up into Kentucky, Murfreesboro, down into Georgia in the Atlanta campaign, and then back up in here with Hood's ill-fated adventure into Tennessee. But let's give a little bit of background, see where it came from. He was born in County Cork, Ireland. His dad was a doctor, and he studied as a pharmacist and then took his entrance exam to medical school, but they rejected his application. He did very poorly in Latin and Greek, and that was a big requirement for students back then. And he was so humiliated that he'd embarrassed his family, he ran off and enlisted in the British Army. And it didn't take him long to figure out he made a bad mistake there, because this was the time where they just treated enlisted men like dirt and beat them for no special cause at all, except an officer could do that. But it made a tremendous impression on Claiborne when he became an officer and commanded first a regiment, then a brigade, then a division in the Confederate Army, how he treated his troops. And he didn't just beat them down because he was an officer and they were enlisted men under his feet. Anything he did, he tried to improve their ability as soldiers in the training and the way he led them and the way he inspired them. And they loved him as a commanding officer. There wasn't anything they wouldn't do for him. And it showed on the battlefield. When they came on the field with that blue flag with the white circle in it, the Yankees knew that was Claiborne's division, and buddy, they were in trouble for the rest of that day. So anyway, he was able, with his mother's inheritance, to purchase his release from the British Army. Then he left Ireland with two brothers and a sister to immigrate to the United States, and they came through New Orleans and then went up river and first settled in Cincinnati. And then a gentleman there who he was working with as a pharmacist in his pharmacy was going to move to Helena, Arkansas. And he asked Patrick to go with him, and he did, and settled in Helena and became a very prominent citizen there. He studied law and became a lawyer. He was a Mason and was just really one of the top people in the Arkansas town of Helena. Wow. So with the war coming on, he decided to throw his lot in with the South. And there's a famous quote that he had in a letter that he wrote, and I'd like to read that to our listeners. He said, "I am with the South in life or in death, in victory or defeat. I never owned a Negro and care nothing for them, but these people," referring to his fellow people in Arkansas, "have been my friends and have stood with me on all occasions. In addition to this, I believe the North is about to wage a brutal and unholy war on a people who have done them no wrong in violation of the Constitution and the fundamental principles of the government. They no longer acknowledge that all government derives its validity from the consent of the governed. They are about to invade our peaceful homes, destroy our property, and inaugurate a servile insurrection, murder our men, and dishonor our women. We propose absolutely no invasion of the North, and furthermore, no attack on them, and only ask to be left alone," as President Davis said.
Yes.
So he joined the Yale Rifles, a company that was made up there in Helena, Arkansas, and they knew that he'd been training them as the Arkansas militia, and they elected him captain. And then he rose quickly to a colonel and over the entire 1st Arkansas Regiment. And they were transferred across the river. And as a brigade commander, when General Hardy was moved up to a division commander, he took over the brigade and fought at Shiloh. He then went with the Army of Tennessee and was split off from the Army of Tennessee and assigned to Edmund Kirby Smith on Bragg's Kentucky invasion. And they came up through Knoxville and Cumberland Gap, and Claiborne's division absolutely destroyed the Yankee army at Richmond, Kentucky. They just about captured every single soldier in that Union Army. That was one of the worst defeats that was ever suffered by the U.S. military. And the only thing was he was shot through the jaw and severely wounded, and then shot again on the retreat back out of Kentucky. And he saved the wagon train. Bragg wanted to abandon his wagon train in Kentucky, and Claiborne said, no, there's too much food and supplies on there we need. And even with his jaw shot and another bullet wound in his side and one in his leg, he stayed with the wagons and saved the wagons. He fought, and that's why he grew a beard to cover up this bad scar in his jaw. He fought at Chickamauga. After Chickamauga, he fought at Missionary Ridge. And he was on the northern end of Missionary Ridge. And Grant's plan was to send Sherman up the northern end of Missionary Ridge and then collapse the Confederate line on Missionary Ridge from right to left or north to south. Sherman never got to the top of Missionary Ridge. Every attack he tried against Claiborne's division up there was thrown back. It was also called Tunnel Hill. It was a railroad tunnel that ran through there. And Claiborne held that position all day and never left it until the Confederate line collapsed in the middle of the ridge, much further south, and all of a sudden he found out he was the only one left up there, so he pulled out that night. The next day, a huge federal force under Joe Hooker was pursuing the Confederate army, and they ordered Claiborne to hold Ringgold Gap, right there on I-75, just south of Chattanooga today. Of course, the interstate wasn't there then. But he guarded that gap and threw back federal attacks that came in there, outnumbered him about 4-1, but he held the gap, and the Confederate wagon train, their artillery, their wounded, and everyone, Bragg's army was able to escape and get all the way back down to Dalton, Georgia.
That's
and
amazing.
Then Claiborne fought in all the battles of the Atlanta campaign at Resaca and Pickett's Mill. That was one where he stopped Sherman. Sherman should have stayed away from Claiborne. He did not have any luck against Claiborne. Every time he ran up against Claiborne's division, he got his nose bloodied. And Claiborne really handed it to him at Pickett's Mill. He held part of the line there near the dead angle at Kennesaw Mountain and then fought in the battles around Atlanta and then was sent south to Jonesboro to try to hold the last railroad that was open to Atlanta. And, of course, Atlanta fell. And then Claiborne, as part of Hood's army, made the march across Georgia, across Alabama, recross the Tennessee River, and headed back into Tennessee to try to capture Nashville. And several blunders that Hood made there. It was the Hood and miscarriage of orders and indecision that allowed Schofield's Union Army Corps to literally tiptoe past the Confederates at Spring Hill on November 29th. Hood was enraged. And the next day, on November 30th, they came up on the hills south of Franklin. The Federal Army was dug in a semicircle south of Franklin. Their left flank was anchored on the Harpeth River. Their right flank was anchored on the Harpeth River. And they had taken over old trenches that were built there a year before and dug out all the leaves and dirt that had washed in. They had a formidable defensive position. And Hood made the rash decision against the advice of all of his officers, Forrest, Cheatham, Claiborne, to launch a frontal attack over 2 miles of open ground, no artillery preparation like before Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Just throw the Confederate army into a suicide charge against this position. And one of Claiborne's brigade commanders, Daniel Govan, was from Arkansas, and he had an Arkansas brigade. All the regiments in his brigade were from Arkansas. And he had gone forward and scouted out this position, and he came back to General Claiborne up there on Winstead and Breezy Hills, which are right on that Highway 31 now, south of Franklin. And he said, General, I don't think many of the boys are going to make it home to Arkansas. And Claiborne's quote was, and it's on the monument there to Claiborne on Winstead Hill, south of Franklin. He said, well, Govan, if we are to die, let us die like men. And about an hour and a half later, he was dead. He was killed on the battlefield there at Franklin. And he was a major general that was killed, and there were 5 other Confederate brigadier generals that were also killed there on the field. And one other quote we would like to read.
So Claiborne was killed there,
General Claiborne.
Yes, Claiborne was killed there. Oh, golly,
yeah.
What a loss.
He was there. And the sad irony was that a couple of days before, they were coming up through southern part of Middle Tennessee, came through a little town called Mount Pleasant, and he saw a church there that reminded him of the church, some of the churches around his homes in Ireland. And it was St. John's Episcopal Church near Mount Pleasant. And he just made the comment, that is such a beautiful ground and cemetery, it almost be worth dying to be buried there. And little did he know, about a week later, he was going to be buried there. And then later on, they reinterred his body and took it back over to Helena, Arkansas, and it's buried up on top of a hill there, just a little bit west of the Mississippi River. And we'll cover that in just a minute, a little bit more.
This is dynamite. This is dynamite. I can't wait to hear the rest of it. Be right back, people.
Have you ever heard of Loving Liberty Ladies? Well, the Loving Liberty Ladies are here to help you learn our American heritage and the way it affects today's society. The Loving Liberty Ladies also have a discussion guide called Proclaim Liberty. And with this guide, you can start your own group in your hometown. Get yours today on our website at lovingliberty.net. Look for our lesson supplements, too. They're free. To hear all the special offers and to join the fight for freedom and liberty, please go to lovingliberty.net.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, we're getting into really some of the best part of the program tonight. I'm really on my seat's edge, so I'm sure you're doing the same thing. So we'll go right back to our history professor. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we're talking about Confederate Irish-born general, since this was his birthday, March the 16th, 1828, General Patrick Claiborne. And we talked about what happened and how he met his death at the Battle of Franklin. He was leading his men out front, and his horse was wounded. And he dismounted, and a staff officer gave him another horse. He put his foot up in the stirrup, and as soon as he put his foot up in the stirrup, an artillery shell hit that horse and literally exploded the horse right out from under him. God. And he said, well, we're losing too many horses. I'm not going to do that again. We went on foot, and that's probably why he got killed, because he was down there same level with his men and where the same huge volume of rifle fire was coming from the Union trenches. So anyway, but before then, this was in January of 1864, he wrote a letter to General Joseph E. Johnston, and General Claiborne said, surrender means that the history of this heroic struggle will be written by the enemy, that our youths will be trained by Northern school teachers, learned from Northern school books, their version of the war, and taught to regard our gallant dead as traitors and our maimed veterans as fit subjects for derision. And if that's not a prophet in his own time, I don't know what is. And then they also had the quote that he said to General Govan about what was going to happen to the army at Franklin. So that was always been one of my favorite Confederate generals, General Patrick Claiborne. And he was such a good officer. He never got the promotion that he deserved, because also in that January, he at Dalton, Georgia, he wrote a letter, and he, like I said, he could look forward and see the future. He knew the South couldn't win a war of attrition. They couldn't replace their losses. They were winning battles, but they couldn't replace the losses that they were taking, where the North would not only replace their losses, but they would increase the size of their army. He said, we need to do something to offset this. And he proposed arming the slaves. And if they served and through the duration of the war, then they would automatically earn their freedom. And that went over like the proverbial screen door in a submarine with the Confederate government. And they say that's probably why he never got promoted past division commander, major general. He should have at least been a corps commander, probably commander of the Army of Tennessee. And if he'd been commander of the Army of Tennessee, either in the Atlanta campaign or that return to Tennessee, I am without question sure that the war would have had a different outcome. But politics once again came in. And then when it was too little too late, in January of 65, a year later, they did start taking blacks into the Confederate Army, and supposedly in large numbers. By then, the war was too far gone. It didn't make much of a difference. Although blacks did serve in the Confederate Army from the very beginning. They went with their master, and they were combat troops. And they got a pension at the end of the war from the states where they served. And to get a pension, you had to have, it's a two-page form that you had to fill out. You had to have it signed off on by two witnesses, and you had to be in a combat billet. You had to be in infantry, artillery, or cavalry. Not a cook, not a blacksmith shoeing horses, not, you know, a teamster driving wagons. You had to actually serve in a combat billet. And there were blacks that served in the Confederate Army, and I always like to point out to our South-hating critics, well, the Confederate Army was integrated in 1861. The U.S. Army wasn't integrated until Harry Truman in 1948. So don't tell us about being racist and, you know, all this kind of nonsense like that. So because these boys had grown up together. They grew up on the farm, plantation. War came along. They went off and joined the Army together. So one other event that we're going to cover. I think we have enough time to get it in. In March was the first battle of ironclad ships. The Confederate Navy under Stephen Mallory, who was Secretary of the Navy, knew that he had to come up with something to offset the huge U.S. Navy. So he decided that they were going to start making these ironclad ships. And in the Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk, when the Federal Navy left it, they set fire to a U.S. frigate, the USS Merrimack, and it burned down to the waterline. And the Confederates got in there, raised it up, pumped the water out, rebuilt the engines, and then put a metal casement on top of the gun deck. And then on March the 8th, 1862, this ship came steaming out into the Hampton's Roads area, Chesapeake Bay there, and went after the Federal blockade squadron. First thing it did, it rammed the frigate, the USS Congress, and it sank. It knocked a big hole in the hull, and it went down. And then it rammed the Cumberland, and it sank. Then it went after the USS Congress and got close enough to blast it and set it on fire with hot shot, where they'd have these hot cannonballs, red hot, and they'd put them down the barrel and then fire them into a ship and set it on fire. Then they went after the USS Minnesota. The Minnesota saw what had happened to these ships, and they took off and ran aground. But the tide was going out, and the Virginia had such a deep draft because it was built over the hull of an ocean-going ship, which you know would be like a big V for the hull to sustain it in storms and rough seas out in the ocean. It couldn't go into that shallow water either. So it went back and repaired some of the damage that it had. Was going to come out the next day and take out the Minnesota and any other ships. There were three other ships that were going after it well. But that night, the U.S. ironclad ship, the Monitor, it was designed and built by John Ericsson, showed up to defend the Minnesota and any of the other ships. Now, during that battle on the 8th, Franklin Buchanan was the commander of the Virginia. And as the Cumberland was going down, or the Congress, rather, was going down and sinking, he brought the Virginia in close to pick up the sailors in the water. That's sort of the unwritten rule of sailors. Even though you sank their ship, you don't let the crewmen drown. You try to get them out. And he was out on the deck, and the Yankee soldiers over at Fort Monroe were shooting at the Confederates that were trying to help the Yankee sailors out of the water, and shot Franklin Buchanan in the leg. So the next day, the command of the Virginia was under Catesby Jones, who was his executive officer, and they fought a three-hour battle with the Monitor, both ships just battering away at each other, and cannonballs and artillery shells were just banging off the metal sides of the Virginia and the hull and the turret of the Monitor. It had a round turret with two guns, and the Virginia had 12 guns, but they could only fire one side at a time. So after a three-hour battle, the Virginia went back into the Norfolk, and every time they would come out again a week or two later and try to attack the blockade squadron, the Monitor would be there, and they'd fight another battle. But the thing is, on March the 9th, 1862, that was the first battle in Navy history of two ironclad ships going at each other anywhere in the world. Now, France and England had already started building ironclad ships, and that was one of Stephen Mallory's arguments. He said, you know, if we get in a war, if the Confederate States gets in a war, our enemy is going to have ironclad ships, and that's something we'd better come up with. And so March 9th battle, 1862, was the first battle between two ironclad ships, and it pretty much ended wooden warships all over the world when the news got out that these two ships had banged and fired away at each other, and they were so formidable that they couldn't knock each other out. So that pretty much meant that wooden ships, the days of wooden ships, were over. The bad thing about the Virginia was that when Norfolk was about to fall to the Yankee army coming up from the south, they did not want the Virginia to fall into hands of the enemy. And they couldn't take it up the James River to Richmond because it had such a deep draft, that ocean-going hull, they couldn't go up the James River. They needed a flat-bottom boat, which the Virginia was not. So they packed it full of gunpowder and took it out into the Chesapeake Bay, set it on fire, and blew it up so the Yankees couldn't get it. In fact, that was the fate of most of the Confederate ironclads that they built. And they had ironclad warships in most of all the major harbors, New Orleans, Mobile Bay, Savannah, Charleston. And there was only one that was ever defeated in a naval battle. And unfortunately, that was a poor old CSS Tennessee in the Battle of Mobile Bay. It took on 19 federal warships. And they literally shot it, surrounded it, and just shot it to pieces. But most of the rest of them were blown up by the Confederates. The Federal Navy couldn't do anything to them, but the Federal Army closing in from the land side on Charleston or Savannah or Mobile or wherever, they didn't want their ship to fall into the hands of the enemy, so they had to, you know, burn it up, blow it up, or whatever. So the Federal Navy couldn't defeat the Confederate ironclads, but the Army caused the Confederates to destroy their own ship. Going back to that battle on March the 9th between the Virginia and the Monitor, well, actually the day before on the 8th, that was the worst defeat of the U.S. Navy up until the attack on Pearl Harbor, having those ships rammed and sunk and burned and drove off some of the other ships in the blockade squadron and the Minnesota running aground. That was the worst U.S. Navy defeat until Pearl Harbor. Thank you, Eddie, for the time. Hope our listeners enjoyed it and learned a little history.
I appreciate what you've done for our listening family, Gene. I certainly do. They've got a lesson. They can take pride in being from the South, being from white. And I'll ask our people, if there's a minister out there, I'll ask them the same question. Call in next week and let me and Gene know, why did God let the South lose the war? Well, people, thank you so much. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Dr. Hill, for coming on. And thank you, little Lizzie, a.k.a. Miss Teenage America, for running this board and making it go so smoothly. Thank you, Blood River Radio family. God willing, same time, same place next week, the 23rd. We'll see you then. Good night, everybody.